Hello and welcome to Speaking Refugee, the Vulner podcast. My name is Sham Jaff, and I will be hosting the six-part podcast series in which we explore the different meanings of vulnerability, a word with many sides. We break them down and make them personal.
Home.
Homeland is like our mother.
Home is where you find opportunity.
It's a source of wisdom.
Safety.
To everyone.
And when you are accepted.
This podcast is a part of the Vulner Project, a research project that aims to understand the vulnerabilities faced by migrants, to enable decision makers to better identify positions of vulnerabilities and address them. Why? Because vulnerability is increasingly used as a tool that allows decision makers to identify migrants in need of special assistance and protection. And many international laws, as well as national policy, reflect this focus. For example, at the European level, vulnerability has also been increasingly used in the legal and policy instruments of the common European asylum system. This means that social workers, public servants deciding on asylum decisions, and asylum judges have to assess information about how vulnerable a person is. This can take place by standardized questionnaires, as we see them in Belgium and Norway, or it can be a decision made solely by people on the ground who are in contact with several asylum seekers, like social workers or public servants. A way of assessing vulnerability that we can find in all the countries researched by Vulner scientists. As you can imagine, the first approach may miss very individual expressions of vulnerability, because, as we will learn in this podcast, vulnerability has a special nature of socially embedded experiences, and very often they can only be assessed when the people trying to measure it have a trustful relationship to the asylum seekers. When asylum seekers fill in questionnaires at the beginning or at a certain step of their asylum seeking process, they may be hesitant to open up about very private expressions of vulnerability. These very complex positions of vulnerability can easily be overlooked, or as a social worker in Norway puts it,
"We are capturing the more serious things, such as disabilities and whether a person is deaf. Less visible needs are more difficult to discover. Vulnerabilities caused by what happened in their home country or on the journey to Norway are not easy to voice. They need to settle down before opening up to difficult experiences and feelings."
In this podcast, we want to do exactly that. We want to focus on the individual experiences and feelings that constitute the vulnerabilities of refugees and that are often overlooked and not so clear. And as we all seem to have our own intuitive and sometimes stereotyped understanding of these vulnerabilities, we also want to hear from the migrants themselves. What are their main life challenges when seeking asylum? We bring together scientific fieldwork and the stories of refugees. We wanted to know, how does vulnerability show at the different stages of the migration process? To answer this question, we talked to three people from three different countries. You will meet Jamila, who is a refugee from Afghanistan and currently in an accommodation center in Belgium.
"For me, to be safe is to have my own freedom."
Gabriel, who has a refugee history himself and is now working with refugees in Uganda.
"When I see them like improving, I feel like I've achieved."
And we talked to Fatima, a humanitarian worker in the MENA region with Besme and Zaytune. One of the areas of concentration is Lebanon.
"My dad was a humanitarian and he was like, you know, kind of encouraging me to get engaged and do more, you know, like for the community."
And we focus on six different topics. Each topic will be part of an episode. Today, we will be talking about the meaning of home. Home has a different meaning for everyone, and we will talk to Fatima, Gabriel, and Jamila about their home or homes and their stories of vulnerability in connection with feeling or not feeling at home, missing home or not missing home. The upcoming episodes will then be about the topics family, food, gender, health, and capital. We think that these six topics are full of examples and stories that help us to raise awareness for the different and very individual expressions of vulnerability. Home. What does that mean to you, home?
I was living like a princess till finishing university. I was living like a princess because I was just getting new clothes, surprises, gifts, reading, enjoying my life.
Jamila is a refugee from Afghanistan. Right now, she's living in a refugee settlement in Belgium, together with her son, who is 2 years old, and her daughter of 7 months. She has been separated from her family when she left her home in 2021. We talked about her home, where it is, how it felt, because home, to most people, is more than just a space or residence where one lives. It is a concept that has to do with belonging, yearning, or homesickness, which is a feeling you may know from your childhood or when you are on a long journey far away from the people you love. For many refugees like Jamila, home is a memory.
Maybe the best part of my life was from the university memories, which was the time that I even didn't have this much problem. No worrying about nothing, all the time enjoying, all the time seeing what to do to make fun.
When we talked to Jamila, the things she would remember about that life, that home in Afghanistan, they sounded like home is a place where you can be a bit carefree, have fun with others, a certain absence of worries maybe, and a place where you can express your personality by the people you meet, things you study, or the style you have.
I was thinking what to wear, what would be matching with my clothes, earrings, how to get nail polish, which color, or which shoes should I wear?
Remembering these times for Jamila seems to help her cope with the difficulties she encounters in the new camp, where she lives with many other people. All of them have left behind what they used to call their homes, places where they had a family, a social life, they had a style, a plan for their futures, and school, friends, university and such.
Good things maybe happen shorter in life. All the time it is about difficulties, worrying, problems. And good things maybe has a short life in our lives. And the good thing, when I was with my family, my husband, so being a complete family, and remembering everything from that is the most beautiful things in my life.
Memories about her family and her home back then make Jamila's current life and her current place more comfortable.
My family were an open-minded family, so they were also educated. My dad was bachelor at math, and also my mom. My sister is journalist. So my dad told me that choose your own.
Jamila was quite happy in Afghanistan until the Taliban took over. She left the country with her kids because being herself, an educated, modern, and fun-oriented young woman, that wasn't possible anymore. The Taliban in Afghanistan especially attacked the rights and freedoms of women and girls since the Western troops left the country in the fall of 2021. As UN Women writes in a report 1 year after the Taliban took over,
women hold no cabinet positions in the de facto administration, which has also abolished the Ministry of Women's Affairs, effectively eliminating women's right to political participation. The Taliban has also banned girls from attending school past the sixth grade and barred women from working most jobs outside the home. Restrictions on women's movement and bodies continue to escalate. In May, the Taliban decreed that women must cover their faces in public and instructed them to remain in their homes, except in cases of necessity. Women are banned from traveling long distances without a male chaperone, and unchaperoned women are increasingly being denied access to essential services.
To Jamila, this country could not be home anymore, and she isn't sure if it will ever be that again.
I don't think so, that Afghanistan would have peace in its dream. It's my thinking. Maybe one day it would have, but in my opinion, Afghanistan just ruined. Maybe from the map. Now no one recognizes Afghanistan as a country. No one recognizes the people of Afghanistan as a human. People are thinking that everybody is just terrorist.
But still, to Jamila, Afghanistan is more than just a memory of good times that have passed. There's more to it.
When Afghanistan has its freedom back, I will definitely go. Because homeland is homeland. Maybe you all know that nothing can replace our homeland. Homeland is like our mother.
My home is situated in base camp.
This is Gabriel.
I have been there for 7 years.
Gabriel lives in the Naki Valley refugee settlement in Uganda.
It's a big settlement and it has got thousands of refugees from different countries. We have Burundians, we have Rwandese, we have Ethiopians, Eritreans, Congolese, Kenyans, and some other nationalities.
So what is home for Gabriel is also a place where many other people who left their countries come to live. And Gabriel thinks that this is a huge advantage.
According to me, I see like it can be better like when they mix nationalities, the different people with different backgrounds, like when they stay together, they learn from each other. They share kind of experiences and they bring peace because they understand each other.
Peace. This is a very important circumstance. Most people who flee their former homes do this because they want to find peace. As for Gabriel, he came from Burundi. He left when he was only a small child.
Burundi is a very small country with three ethnic groups. There is the Tutsi, Twa, and the Hutu. So during the colonial regimes, the three ethnic groups were not of the same level. They were not living in the same standards. The colonial masters who are Belgians, they were using the Tutsi to administer on their behalf. So all those conflicts you have been hearing from Burundi were all those years, the root is caused by that.
The conflicts Gabriel talks about stem from Burundi's colonial history. It gained independence from Belgium in 1962. In 1972, there was the first Burundian genocide, called the Ikiza. Mass killings of Hutus by the Tutsi-dominated army. The death toll of the Ikiza is estimated to be between about 100,000 and 150,000 people killed, while some estimates of the death toll go as high as 300,000. The reason I am telling you this is because since then, until 2005, Burundi has not often been in a state that you could call peace, or at least stable. The Hutu and the Tutsi, as Gabriel mentioned, were struggling to build a government that represents both parties equally. In 1992, 20 years after the first genocide, the government created a new constitution to solve this ongoing conflict. It was meant to create a multi-party system in Burundi, but then a civil war broke out. In 1993, the second genocide followed. Mass killings of Tutsis in 1993 by the Hutu majority, like a prequel to the Rwandan genocide in 1994. The Burundian civil war lasted until 2005. So this is, in very, very short, the historical background of Gabriel's former home country, Burundi. And until today, although he was a really small boy back then, he thinks about his country.
I see how someone can reach all this age and doesn't know where he was born from. So it's always me thinking about my home country, but getting a plan of going there, I don't see it.
He also told us that if there were still parents to come back to, he might think differently and the chances of him going back might be higher. But his mother was resettled to Australia, and his father, he left the family in 1996.
In 1996, that's when my dad, he decided to go and work far from home. He packed everything in the morning and he told us that I'm going to work, but I'll be coming back after 6 months. After going, he didn't come back. We waited 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, up to now. We don't know where he is.
One of the stops on his journey from Burundi to Uganda was Tanzania, where Gabriel went to school.
They would make us sing our national anthem. He would feel like we are still in Burundi. So everyone would be having that courage of going to school because all teachers would always tell us, you are the Burundi of tomorrow. So it was kind motivating. You'd go to school with a goal to achieve.
Back then, his goal, as the goal of many of his peers, was to go back to Burundi one day.
Would not see ourselves like we're going to remain refugees for the entire life.
Today, Gabriel is a teacher himself. He works with the Refugee Law Project that wants to empower asylum seekers, refugees, deportees, IDPs, and host communities to enjoy their human rights and lead dignified lives. They teach refugees English with a focus on helping them to learn this language to request for their rights. Education is central in this approach, and for Gabriel.
If I look at how I used to be and how I am now, it's because of education. If it wasn't education, I would not be working.
His students learn a lot from Gabriel's experiences.
Telling them how the language is going to help them, because sometimes when they're in the camp, they don't think that a language can become a challenge, not until when they go beyond the settlement.
Gabriel has made himself at home in Uganda.
When I'm in Uganda, I feel like I'm Ugandan. I don't distance myself from the other Ugandans. So I feel like it is my home.
And what does this home look like?
So my home is not like having iron sheets. I've tried to put some tiles.
Mm-hmm.
There is a kitchen. There is a sitting room. I have my bedroom. My child also has hers. And in the sitting room, there is a TV. Sometimes we relax and watch.
Sound familiar? a sitting room, a bedroom, and watching TV with your family. Sitting there is what makes Gabriel feel at home now, and also the way his family organizes and communicates in these rooms.
If your home is good, also children will grow up with some disciplines, because a home must be a unit that brings organization, discipline, teaching manners to children. That's how I consider a home to be. Because if you're not brought up in a home, you're on the streets. You take your life the way you want. You learn manners from different people. Some of them are bad manners. So a home is a source of wisdom to everyone.
So what we learned by listening to the stories of Jamila and Gabriel, of course, home is an important aspect of how safe and comfortable we feel in our lives. To many people, home is where we come from and where we were born. In Jamila's case, this is still the case. She has only been in Europe for a short amount of time, so home is a place mainly in her memories, the good life she once had in Afghanistan. Gabriel has a much, much longer history as a refugee. He fled many years ago in the mid-90s, and he has been in Uganda for 7 years now. While he refers to Burundi, the country he left when he was very little, as his home, he also says that he has become at home in Uganda today. So, what is home?
Home is where you find opportunity, where you find safety, and when you are accepted.
This is Fatima.
I'm Fatima, and I work in the humanitarian sector in the MENA region. I have experience in Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey. I have some engagement with some local organizations providing humanitarian and development assistance to Syrian and refugees and host communities and Palestinians as well living in Lebanon. And I have been in the humanitarian field myself since 2014, and have been engaged in different capacities, but mainly in fields related to protection, education, food security, and livelihoods.
Fatima started as a volunteer in 2009. And she says that her father was her main inspiration.
My dad was a humanitarian, and he was like, you know, kind of encouraging me to get engaged and do more, you know, like for the community. I'm Syrian. And at the time, we didn't have war and we didn't have any like urgent need to think of what is it to be a humanitarian. At the time, we were like, you know, we want to serve the community. We want to help, you know, people around us who are maybe, you know, like experiencing certain difficulties or challenges, whether it is related to disabilities or whether related, you know, like any challenge, whatever we can help, we wanted to help.
When the war broke out in Syria in 2011, it seemed obvious to Fatima to help.
Then when, you know, the whole war started in Syria, I could not help it but just like, you know, kind of get involved in the response. And it was very natural for me to just like be in the field.
She worked in Syria for several years and then went to London to study and do her master's degree in global public policy. After that, she continued her work in the humanitarian sector.
It's so rewarding in the sense, you know, that these, like, you know, few hours, it's not just like, you know, about what you are bringing to yourself. It is about what you are offering to others, you know, and the difference that you bring to their lives. It is kind of, you know, a social commitment.
Within her work, she constantly tries to be in contact with the refugees she works with. She wants them to be heard. She wants their voices to be part of the conversation.
It is a growing conversation in the humanitarian sector. We need to hear from refugees first. They are entitled to talk about their own experiences, what they go through, and from their own eyes and, you know, in their own words. And we're trying to push for that increasingly.
And by the way, this is why she happily agreed to be part of this podcast series. So Fatima has been working with refugees for quite a long time. And within this time, she noticed a change in the way many people tend to look at refugees, think of them, and even talk about them publicly.
We used to be more compassionate. We used to be more welcoming to it. Nowadays, I think there is a stigma related to the word refugee. This stigma takes away from these humans' identity, because like we think that, you know, like a refugee is coming and, you know, it's going to be a burden for our economy, a burden for our country.
Fatima observes that many refugees tend to dislike being seen like this, like a burden. They feel and fear the stigma. Instead of being stigmatized, they want to be part of the society they came to. They want to contribute in a positive way. And so to be seen as vulnerable is quite ambivalent for them. To be recognized as a refugee, to have the status and to be seen as vulnerable, it comes with certain rights, human rights, rights under the Geneva Refugee Convention, and certain national laws. Some countries, therefore, try not to give the status to a lot of refugees. And then, that makes them vulnerable. Vulnerable because they are restricted certain rights, and also because they may be seen as illegal. And being illegal, not having any rights, this might well be one of the most vulnerable statuses one can be forced into. This is what Gabriel meant when he was talking about teaching refugees about their rights, and part of the rights refugees have is being recognized as vulnerable.
Lack of this documentation prevent them from being able to access their basic rights and accordingly affects their everyday experiences in terms of access to health services, to work opportunities, and to education or any other basic needs. In addition, it would affect their sense of safety and security.
During her work, Fatima met a woman from Syria. Her story is an example of just how vulnerable refugees get if their status is not clear, if their basic rights as refugees are not met at all.
She lost her husband in the conflict in Syria, and she had to flee to Lebanon in 2015. She ended up settling in an informal settlement in a tented camp. These settlements are not established by the UN or according to any of standards. Basically, just some wood structures. So there are no like services of sanitation or sewer system or any infrastructure basically that would support their daily life and function. She came to Lebanon with her three children, and one of them had a disability. He was unable to kind of see properly, and she was unable to being, you know, like not having the proper documentation. She was unable to rent a place. She didn't have access to work, and she could not register her children at school. And given that they also live in a remote area, and they don't have financial means to cover the transportation cost, which is increasing rapidly. So she ended up living in that informal settlement.
This example also shows how having or not having a home can make people feel safe or very vulnerable. It can be part of the basic protection that any human being needs. Not having this basic protection, a place where you can feel safe, it is one way vulnerability can show.
She was trying to have any feel of kind of stability. Like she was trying to find a way out, like, you know, how can I make sure that my children have a decent life, you know, have an apartment or like rent at least a room or anywhere that, you know, like would protect them. However, she was unable to do so. And there was a few, like, you know, incidents when there was like a storm and snow, and they had to actually flee out of the camp.
To understand the situation in Lebanon better, you might need some facts about the history of Syrian refugees there and the development of the relationship between the Lebanese government on the one side and the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, on the other. First, when the Syrian war began and Syrian people left their country, Lebanon was the first country many tried to enter. Between 2011 and 2016, some 1.5 million refugees are estimated to have entered Lebanon. Lebanon has the highest number of refugees per capita in the world, one refugee per four nationals. Second, Lebanon adopted an open border policy to respond to the influx of people from Syria until the end of 2014. This policy was based on three bilateral agreements signed between Lebanon and Syria in 1993 that guaranteed the free movement of goods and people and the freedom to reside, work, and practice economic activity. And third, in February 2014, a new government was formed in Lebanon. And in October, the government adopted a decision on Syrian displacement to Lebanon, where it specifically aimed at reducing the numbers of Syrian refugees in the country by reducing access to territory and encouraging Syrian nationals to return to Syria. Additional to that, Lebanon issued a new visa entry and residency for Syrian nationals, which explicitly says that Syrians with the status of displaced are not to be admitted in Lebanon, with two exceptions: those previously registered as displaced and those who meet certain conditions. Those conditions are strict, only applying to minors, disabled people who have already been resettled in other countries, and those who are in need of life-saving health treatment. And furthermore, Lebanon asked UNHCR in January of 2015 to halt new registration of Syrian refugees, then requested in April 2015 to deregister around 1,400 Syrian refugees who had arrived in Lebanon after January 5 of 2015. So many refugees in Lebanon are either not registered at all, they lack healthcare, education, and very often residency permits that would allow them to make themselves at home in Lebanon. Refugees are characterized in Lebanon as displaced, foreigners, or illegal residents. On the other hand, Lebanon shifted the humanitarian response to provide shelter, food, education, health, and even protection to its refugee population to international and national organizations like the UNHCR. As the Vulner Research Project in Lebanon states, in Lebanon, the vulnerability of refugees is influenced by the balance of power between the secularization of the response and the extent to which humanitarian actors are allowed and able to respond to refugees' needs. Fatima and her colleagues are such humanitarian actors and wanted to help the woman, who is one of many who suffered from the hard circumstances Lebanon imposed upon Syrian refugees.
Basically, we came up with, like, you know, some ideas, including, for example, establishing women producers groups where women are trained on dairy production. And we have provided them with all the assets needed. And then we ensured that, you know, women are actually the leaders of these production units that we have established for them. And we gave them the needed skills for them in order to manage this small business, and technical training in terms of dairy production, and also business related of how to manage their books, how to, you know, like, manage their income, profit, and, you know, overhead for the business. And you know, women were actually trying, you know, like, to own that. They were really active. They were trying to find their own, you know, like, mechanism of how to distribute roles, how to use what they are best at at these, you know, production units, and for the best of these production units. So that was a really successful experience.
They also helped other women to become better in manual work and to organize themselves and find ways to contribute to the Lebanese society. This project was called Women Workshops. It helped women gain more knowledge and become a part of the Lebanese society, step by step. In another episode of this series, we will come back to these workshops and talk about how gender also plays a role in the vulnerability of refugees. But let's get back to our topic here, home. We've already discussed one aspect of the concept of home that can lead to increased vulnerability, and how this shows, especially in Lebanon, the lack of legal residency can seriously impact the well-being and security of refugees. Another factor can be seen in the kind of accommodation that is provided to refugees. As the Vulner Research Project in Lebanon says, for many interviewees, the place of residence, like in a camp, outside a camp, close to the city, and so on, plays a major role in refugees' vulnerability. For instance, the situation of a refugee who lives in a camp is different than the situation of someone who rented a house. And a third factor affects the more social aspects of a home, as Fatima observed.
When you talk to refugees, there is a lot of a sense of uncertainty, like displacement in the sense not only physical displacement, but like they were deprived of their context, what they are used to, you know, they know their neighbors, their kind of, you know, safety groups, their, you know, parents, their immediate family.
Home is where your heart is, and your heart is where you have people around that you love and that make you feel safe and understood. When people have to leave their countries because of political unrest or war or other conflicts, they have to rely on helping hands like Fatima's or Gabriel's, people who help them learn other languages and all the things they need to know about their human rights and their rights as asylum seekers.
We cannot forget that, you know, there were many Lebanese people who were very supportive, and they kind of took in those, you know, people who were coming on their own. They didn't know how to access services. And here, services, I'm not just saying the aid services, like, you know, like, how do I access education if I want to restart over, you know, how can I rent a house, who do I talk to, you know, where can I sleep the first few nights, and so on. So there was a lot of support of the host community, of course, and, you know, those who would just, like, you know, meet along the way, and other refugees also traveling, and they just become family, as I said, because they have shared interests of not having anything, you know, and trying to find something. So that is beautiful to see.
I too think this is a beautiful thing. Not having a home, yes, that makes us quite vulnerable as human beings. Being denied a home, like the woman in Fatima's story, must be such a horrible situation. Therefore, the situation in Lebanon is quite hard. Denying refugees basic rights means the vulnerabilities start at a very basic level, like a home, a place where you are safe. But home as a concept can mean so much more, as Jamila said in the beginning.
Homeland is like our mother.
She misses her parents, her university friends, partying, following fashion trends, and many more things that belong to some kind of daily culture. She hopes to go home someday, and by that she means Afghanistan. Home to her is mostly a place in her memories, for now. Her journey has been much shorter than Gabriel's or Fatima's. As Gabriel and Fatima also showed, making a place your home has to do with having or finding a family and friends, people you can rely on, people who educate you, who help you learn a new language or the legal rights you have, or even manual work or organizing yourselves in connection with others, other refugees, humanitarian workers.
For many Syrians, when they left Syria, they fled war, they fled inequality, they fled, you know, like lack of opportunity, fear. you know, coming to Lebanon, I guess, as we said, some were able to capitalize on the opportunities or identify possible opportunities, make friends that they called family.
This was the first of 6 episodes of Speaking Refugee, the Volner podcast. In the upcoming episodes, we will explore more facets of vulnerability, like family, food, gender, or health. We will do this together with Fatima, Gabriel, and Jamila. We hope you'll join us again. My name is Sham Jeff. Until next time. Credits. The Volner Project is carried out by an international research consortium involving partners from 9 research institutions located in 6 different countries. It is financed by the EU under the Horizon 2020 Work Program. This episode was designed by Haus 1, Karina Schröder, Sham Jaff, Katharina Alexander, and Katrin Rönnecke, based on the input from the Volner team, Susanne Höb, Luc Leboeuf, Zoe Krien, Maria Malouf, and Sophie Nakuera. Editing and sound design, Karina Schröder. Script, Katrin Rönnecke. Music by Blue Dot Sessions.